Michael Ware returns to Conversations today. Michael's a journalist and a documentary maker. He's a former correspondent for CNN and Time magazine, who delivered some of the most reliable and candid reporting from the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. The first time Michael Ware came on this program was back in 2006. Now, just put your mind back there. That was at a time when George Bush was still president. This was before the troop surge, at a time when Al-Qaeda in Iraq was on a rampage. The three great tribes of Iraq, the Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds, were splitting into their own camps. This is what Michael Ware said back then, in 2006, when I asked him what would happen when the United States got out of Iraq.
You have no idea of the blood that will flow in one form or another. It would be mayhem. Now, you know, areas of the country would remain under Sunni control. Most of the country and the capital would fall to the Shia government, the installed government and so forth. But no one would be able to really effectively exercise control. So you would see a proliferation of terrorist camps. You would see all sorts of forces operating and breathing within Iraq if the Americans pull out now. So whether you were for or against the war, whether you like the wars, the way the war's being fought or not, it's too late, America. You're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. You broke it, you pay for it.
Well, that was 8 years ago in 2006. And here we are, and all these things have come to pass. Now a super hardline jihadist force called IS, the Islamic State, is in control of huge parts of Iraq and Syria. And to many people, and people like me, this just seemed to come out of nowhere. Their leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is a shadowy figure. And only yesterday there was a video released which showed the apparent beheading of an American journalist called James Foley. Michael Ware knows these people in IS. They kidnapped him in Baghdad. Now, Michael is in the process of making a documentary about the Islamic State, and it's a pleasure to have him back. Hello, Michael. Welcome back.
Hello, Richard. It's good to be back, but dark circumstances that have brought us together again.
Yet again. Strange to hear your voice back then. You were just on your way back to Baghdad when we spoke.
Yes, that seemed to be my constant state in those days, always on my way to Baghdad.
It pretty much came true what you predicted there, exactly as you said, actually. It's not common to see such prescience on this program. God knows I've got the future wrong often enough.
Yes, well, and look, I would have been happy to have been proved wrong. But unfortunately, as things are playing out, it's just as we feared.
We tend to get news on Iraq in episodes, in grabs, here and there. And if you aren't following it closely, it all seems quite bewildering. What I'd like to do is to use your experience to go over this story and find out how we got to where we are today in that part of the world. And let's start with the origin of IS, the Islamic State. These are people that began as Al-Qaeda in Iraq. How were they different from the rest of Al-Qaeda, from Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda?
These guys truly are the legacy of our Western invasion of Iraq in 2003. Al-Qaeda, or certainly groups like the Islamic State, were not present in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. He didn't tolerate them, and there was no local taste or support for them. It was only when we took away that regime that allowed them to flourish and to step into the breach, to step in to that vacuum. And when that happened, there was one man who saw, one jihadi who saw the opportunity. Rather than having to go far to attack the great Satan, the United States and the Western interests, he saw them arrive into effectively the Holy Land. They'd come to him, and he was the one who went to Iraq and said, I have a new brand of holy war that I want to unleash here and now. He even spelled out his grand vision to Osama bin Laden in a letter he wrote in late 2003 that was intercepted and then released by the Americans. Step by step, he laid it all out, that he would introduce suicide bombings and operations where there'd been absolutely no taste for them whatsoever. He would introduce a sense of true jihad, and he would inflame a sectarian hatred of such a kind that it would lead to the bloodiest of all types of civil war. And every single thing he said he was going to do, he did it. And what we're seeing is all the legacy of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi.
Zarqawi wrote that letter to Osama bin Laden like he was the godfather of the Al-Qaeda movement. But pretty soon they became estranged from Osama bin Laden. Why and how? Yes.
Well, some of this history is lost in the shadowy murkiness of secret jihadi politics. But in Afghanistan, when it was the Taliban and Al-Qaeda's Afghanistan, when it was the Afghanistan of Osama bin Laden, Zarqawi went to Afghanistan, but he did not join Al-Qaeda. Similarly, Al-Qaeda did not bring him into the fold. He had a terror camp there with his own group, with its own goals and objectives. And once the Americans invaded Afghanistan and ousted the Taliban, he, like so many others, fled, and eventually he comes to Iraq to unleash his own kind of holy war. The difference, even in that early genesis between Zarqawi and bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, or classic Al-Qaeda, was not just tactics, but also the ultimate goals, the strategic objectives. Yes, they both want to establish this Islamic caliphate, but they both had very different views about how to get there. Zarqawi was far more bloodthirsty than even bin Laden ever purported to be. In fact, during the Iraq War, when Zarqawi had begun this campaign of unrelenting beheadings, many of them on TV, just like we saw with this poor American journalist, James Foley, that horrified even bin Laden. And the current leader of Al-Qaeda, who replaced bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, they wrote to Zarqawi saying, God bless you, brother, and your great fight, but can you tone down the bloodlust? And he ignored them. In fact, he ramped it up. The other key thing is, Zarqawi believed that the path to the great Islamic caliphate that they always wanted was to invoke this hatred, the sectarian hatred, which, if our Muslim viewers will pardon me, but it's akin in Christianity to Catholic and Protestant. If you consider bin Laden and Zarqawi Catholic, and then the Shia population are the Protestants, he believed that by attacking the Shia and just killing and killing and killing until the Shia rose up and attacked, only then would this great sleeping giant, which was the Sunni community, would rise up and wipe away the Shia forever. And then we would have the true Islamic State. And bin Laden never believed in that.
So the focus of bin Laden's hatreds that made him different from a lot of the jihadis at the time was his hatred of America and the West. Who is the main object of hatred then of IS, Islamic State? Is it the Shia or is it the United States?
Well, this cuts to the quick of a key debate that has long festered and bubbled away within these jihadi circles. And as simply put as I can, it's an argument about the near enemy and the far enemy. The far enemy is America and the West, taking the fight to them wherever they are, in their homelands even, as we saw tragically in September 11. The other school of jihadi thought is to attack the near enemy. Now, all these jihadis, bin Laden and Zarqawi included, despise these local regimes in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan,
Syria,
all these countries, right? Because in one way or another, they're either propped up by America or propped up by Iran. And what's worse than being a Christian, what's worse than being a Jew, is distorting the true faith of Islam. That is done by the Shia en masse or by these apostate governments who, to their minds, sell out Islam by aligning with the great Satan or with another power. And the sin that they're committing against the faith is far greater than anything else a non-believer can do. So people like Zarqawi believed, first and foremost, we attack these governments here in the Holy Lands. Like, Zarqawi's a Jordanian by birth. His first war, when he came out of prison and was radicalized, was against the Jordanian government. When he was in Afghanistan, his terror camp was a Jordanian militant organization. One of the first great acts that Zarqawi committed in the Iraq War, his first great piece of arrival, was in August 2003, when the war was just an occupation by American forces. There was a battle going on, but it was always in the background. An American soldier killed here, two Americans wounded there. It was something you couldn't put your hands on. It was always, you know,
nebulous.
Beyond, correct. The war changed. In many ways, I would argue, the real Iraq War began in August 2003. I lived just down the road from the Jordanian embassy, And I was at home and my house shook when Zarqawi sent the first suicide bombing of the American wall into the Jordanian embassy.
Not against America?
No.
Against the Jordanian government.
He blew up the Jordanian embassy, right, killing 11 people.
Because the Jordanians, to him, are traitors. They were traitors.
They're his own people. That's his greatest anger. But then he quickly followed up 2 weeks later by blowing up the UN headquarters and killing Sergio Vieira de Mello. So he attacks the near enemy. Then he attacks the great representation of the foreigners who are coming to help. His third, with a week later, a car bomb in the holy Shia city of Najaf that killed one of the most powerful, or the most powerful, Shia political force, a cleric, killed him and 90-odd Shia pilgrims. So in the space of those 3 weeks, he started a whole new war that became the real Iraq war. And we very clearly saw his real enemies. And he effectively, in those 3 weeks, drove out everyone except the US military. The NGOs had to leave. He blew up the Red Cross using an ambulance. I mean, there was no way for these people who came to give help and have no role in any kind of a fight, to operate. He denied Iraq to them. And he began his assault on the Shia, which continued for 4 years. He was the death of a thousand cuts. Every time he'd bomb them, every time he'd kill them, every time he'd do something, their leaders would say, calm down, don't react, don't react. Let's not take the bait, let's not take the bait. He kept chipping away. And when it wasn't creating that anger that he was after, he knew how he could do it. And we saw that in February 2006. What's said to be the equivalent of the third holiest place in the world for Shia Muslims was a mosque in the town of Samarra. And it literally had a golden dome. It's known as the Golden Dome Mosque. It's sort of like, you know, our smaller Vatican, so to speak. He blew it up one morning. Destroyed it. And after that, there was no holding the Shia back.
This is such an old story, isn't it? This, right throughout history, no matter what the religion, religious fundamentalists, the people they hate more than anything is not the heretic, not the person of the other faith. It's the apostate,
yes,
the one who's within the faith but is a bit different.
Yes.
That's the real focus of your hatred, because they're distorting what you believe in. The heretic, well, I can live with the heretic almost, but it's the apostate that you hate more than anyone.
It does invoke a particularly distorted kind of dark passion in believers. I mean, I've long said, and I may have said it on this program, I'm not sure, that I think one of the greatest killers on the planet is TB. And I don't mean by that tuberculosis. True belief of any kind. It can be a blinding belief in democracy that one could argue led us to this mess in the first place, that we would implant a shining beacon of democracy in the Middle East and it would spread. Well, we've seen it spread all right. Or it's a fanatical belief in say, a religion. These people cannot be negotiated with. I mean, there's a dark strength in that. But it's a truly immovable force.
Now, Michael, are you the only Westerner to have been kidnapped by these people and lived to tell the tale?
Well, certainly as far as I'm aware, and certainly as in terms of the Iraq War until 2011, absolutely. Everyone else that we're aware of, any Westerner or South Korean, they all met sad and tragic ends.
You didn't, very fortunately. What can you tell me about that day, how that day unfolded?
Well, it's a bit of a story, but essentially it's towards the end of 2004 and Zarqawi has arrived and he started to ramp it up and ramp it up. We have a Sunni insurgency and Iraqi insurgency being fought by, you know, Iraqi military officers for patriotic and political reasons. But Zarqawi, who started so small and eventually came to dominate the entire war, was there to fight a holy war and infect the rest of the fight with that. And that was beginning. That was picking up real momentum. It's in the midst of this, as his power is rising and rising, he's coming into his ascendancy, that there was a part of the capital, Baghdad, where the American embassy is and the seat of the Iraqi government's power and parliament. And this area that we're talking about called Haifa Street, it was a special kind of hell for the Americans. It was controlled by a group of former military officers and insurgents who, for nationalistic and political reasons, were fighting, resisting the occupation. Every time the American unit who was responsible for that area left their camp and went into Haifa Street, they had a 70% expectation of contact with the enemy. Women would throw potatoes on the streets like hand grenades to watch the soldiers react, and then the men would throw the real hand grenades to where the soldiers dive. This was a shining jewel of the resistance, in the heart of the capital, within mortar range of the US embassy. Something Zarqawi wanted. Bit by bit, he started sending fighters to help these insurgents. And then ones became twos, and twos became fours, and so on, till one day, after a particularly furious battle with the Americans, where the Americans were driven out of the area, and one of their tanks was left burning in the street. It wasn't the insurgents who claimed victory that day, it was Zarqawi's men. Indeed, they stood atop the burning tank, waving their banner in victory.
The Al-Qaeda banner?
Yes. The people who became, short time later, became the Islamic State. First of Iraq and then of Iraq and Syria, and now the Islamic State. This was a major act. Essentially, Zarqawi, under the noses of the might of the American military, in the midst of their occupation, had taken over a central part of the capital within striking distance of the American embassy. I learned about this because the insurgents who'd controlled the area were friends of mine. I got to know them over a long period of time. When they were overthrown by Zarqawi's people, they were not happy. They didn't share these goals of holy war. They wanted to help their people, not to impose this religious order upon them. So when they were overthrown, the commander sent one of his junior commanders to me, to my house, and said, this is what's happened. Zarqawi's taken over part of the centre of the capital of the country. You need to come and see it to confirm it, tell the world. So this junior commander took me back into this Haifa Street area, took me into the valley. When we get in there, I'm in the back seat of the car. We're trying not to be seen, but there was clearly dozens, scores of Zarqawi's fighters on the streets, flaunting their power. And the main boulevard was Zarqawi's Al-Qaeda flags, in open defiance. So between the headrests with a tiny handycam, I'm filming just these flags, purposely not filming the fighters or their faces. We make one pass, I film the banners, come back, I'm filming them, I can now go and tell the world. Well, unfortunately, that's when we were spotted. I filmed my kidnap, my grab. But all I have left is about 16 frames of it. What you see is from the median strip with one of the banners fluttering from a palm tree is one of Zarqawi's fighters stepping out and pulling the pin on a live grenade and then waving his hand at the car, which forced us to stop, and we were then swarmed by armed Zarqawi fighters. The man with the grenade is the one who opened the back door and grabbed me, and with the grenade at my head pulled me out. I then had every kind of weapon you can imagine poking in the back of my head, in my ribs, in my back, in my stomach. Some time passed. Sometimes it's hard to tell you how long. But before long, I was dragged behind a building. And there, hastily slung, was one of their flags. Exactly one of the flags you see in the beheading videos. I was placed under that flag. Masked men then lined up behind me, just like in the beheading videos. And then a masked man stood beside me with a knife, just like the beheading videos. I was about to be beheaded. And they were going to film it with my own camera. In fact, there was two fellows standing in front of me, arguing, I think, with each other about how to work my camera. While they were arguing about the camera, the insurgent commander who brought me in there chose that moment to pipe up. And he said to these Al-Qaeda guys, well, what are you going to do? And they said, well, what do you think we're going to do? We're going to kill this guy. We're going to cut his head off. That's when he saved my life. He said, this man is my guest. I brought him in here. If you kill him, you dishonor me. You know who I am. They said, we do know who you are. You're a great fighter. We have no disrespect for you. He goes, well, you'll be disrespecting me if you do this. They said, well, you bring a Westerner in here and expect him to leave alive? No, we're going to do it. Then he played his ace in the hole. He said, you know who I work for, the very powerful commander in this area. Who do you think told me to bring him in here? effectively placing me under the umbrella of the major commander's protection. He said, do you want me to get him on the phone? And it was that, the implied threat of a turf war that Al-Qaeda could not afford over me, that saved my life. It was through gritted teeth these foreign Al-Qaeda fighters shoved me back. And I was bundled into the car with my insurgent commander friend, and we went back to my house. I know what it's like to stand there, waiting for that moment.
When you got back to the house, what state were you in?
I don't remember much of the drive back. There was my driver, Sammy, my boxing coach, the insurgent commander. I don't think we spoke a lot. And then there was much excitement when we got back because, you know, the insurgent commander and my driver started telling the rest of my staff what had happened. And I remember this one moment where my chief translator pulled me aside with the driver, Sammy. And Sammy said to the translator, now you translate every word I'm about to say. So I want Mr. Mick to hear this. And he said, Mr. Mick, we died today. Every day from now on is a new life. And then he went home and spent some time with his family. I went upstairs to my bedroom and I didn't leave it for 3 days. And then after those 3 days, whenever I had to get into a car just to drive around the corner, just to go to a press conference, to do anything, I wanted to throw up. I got over that in time. I certainly didn't leave Iraq. In fact, within a few weeks, I went into the Great Battle of Fallujah.
That advice you got at the end there, that everything now is a gift. You can say that, but can you feel it? Can you feel it afterwards?
Well, I didn't for a long time. I think I'm certainly starting to now. You know, it's the same with the veterans of any wars. I'm sure it's the same with the correspondents who covered them. You know, from World War I to World War II, Korea, Vietnam, any of this. You know you're never going to be the same. But then again, who would want to be? You certainly see the world through different eyes, and that will always be thus. You know, I may walk with ghosts, but I still consider myself privileged for that honour.
There's a temptation to think that over there is real life. That's the horrible truth. And the world you live in now in Brisbane is some sweet little deluded fantasy. But it's not right. It's not true. That's weird there. This is normal here. Do you know that now? And do you believe that now?
Well, you know, one man's weird is another man's normal. But I'll tell you one thing. Yes, of course, there's a certain reality that I will say we are somewhat, I think, divorced from the reality of life in many ways. And until some terrible disease or something strikes our families, you know, we're very fortunate. And for that, I'm evangelistic in the way I say that we in the West, in this privileged bubble, must be thankful every day, every hour, because you haven't seen a refugee camp. You haven't seen a village terrorised by the Taliban. You haven't seen... I mean, the way the majority of the world ends up living their lives in these villages and ghettos and slums, we are beyond lucky, and we need to know that. By the same token, that then liberates us and I think gives us an obligation to truly, you know, extract the juice of life, because there's so many others who cannot. So I guess in one sense there's a celebration of that, but there's also another sense, I mean, being in those extreme circumstances, and it's not something that, you know, I advocate or something that even now I long for, but I'll tell you what, you find a clarity to existence that it's impossible to find here. When you're under gunfire, when you may be about to be overrun, when you're surrounded, you find out what matters. And that informs the rest of your life. All those little things just fade away. And the only things that are important become important. And so that's illuminated, you know, my existence now. Swings and roundabouts, mate.
On air, online, and podcast, This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
I'm with legendary journalist Michael Ware, a man who's making a documentary at the moment about IS, the Islamic State, the jihadist organisation that now controls large parts of Iraq and Syria. Michael was for some years a journalist for Time and CNN who reported from Baghdad during the insurgency and during the troop surge as well. So we've been talking about al-Zarqawi, who was the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which later became IS, Islamic State. And then he was assassinated in an airstrike, a US airstrike, in 2006. What happened to that group after his death?
Well, they carried on. In many ways, they never skipped a beat. He was instantly replaced. I mean, these are organisations that are built for loss. These guys know they're at war. So they lose foot soldiers, they lose mid-ranking management and command, they lose their top strategic thinkers, their religious specialists. They're replaced, they're replaced, they're replaced. It's one of the hallmarks of these organisations that they will endure. Shortly after Zarqawi's death, though, within 6 months or so, the Americans finally turned the oil tanker of their mission. They realised, after all those years, 4,000-odd combat deaths, that the men they were fighting day-to-day, these Iraqi insurgents, these former military officers, were not really their enemy. When America finally had the blinkers taken from their eyes and were able to engage with these men and they cut a deal, the Bush administration put 107,000 of them on the US government payroll to provide local security, just like they've been offering since day one of the war. And the insurgent war stopped like that.
Now, these were the guys that the Bush administration employed. Were they the former Iraqi army under Saddam Hussein?
Yes, the Baathists. Look, one thing that everyone has underestimated or discounted from day one, and which I learned very early when I arrived in Baghdad after the invasion and headed south from Kurdistan, the Iraqis love being Iraqi. They love their country, just like we do. Aussie, Aussie, oi, oi. They love Iraq, and they have a strong military tradition. These men, as they told me then, they didn't fight for Saddam, they fought for Iraq during the regime, and afterwards they carried on defending, as they saw it, their country.
And to them, does someone like al-Zarqawi and these al-Qaeda in Iraq, they look like outsiders and foreigners, don't they?
Oh, they hated them. Right. They shared no goals.
Right, because they were al-Qaeda in Iraq, not of Iraq.
Yes, exactly. Now, over time, they became of Iraq as the idea of them infected and infected more and more people. I mean, as they said to me, right in the first summer of the entire war, I said, Michael, can you explain to us? We never allowed al-Qaeda in this country, and we don't want any kind of holy war. In the 70s and 80s, as a military officer, I did Ranger and Pathfinder training in the United States. During the Iran-Iraq war, I used US satellite imagery to kill Iranians. No one on this planet hates Iran more than we do. Can you please explain to me how we've ended up on the opposite side of this thing? And it took 4 or 5 years until the Americans were able to connect with that. But once they did, once they put them on the payroll as local security forces, the attacks on the Americans from the insurgents went to nothing. And the next morning, a massive chunk of al-Qaeda woke up dead. Because we didn't know where they slept at night, but they did. We're bound by the rules of war. They were not. They just went out and took care of the problem. So within a year or so of Zarqawi's death, his organisation was on the back foot, for the first time, was on the back foot. But that didn't last because our attention wavered. We left the job to the Iraqi government, who really did not share our interests. And the whole thing unravelled. And al-Qaeda became the Islamic State of Iraq, which became the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And they became stronger, better, more capable, more daunting, more dangerous than they'd ever been before.
It seems like these ultra-jihadist movements can only really thrive, Michael, in a vacuum, a power vacuum, a lawless part of the world. The Taliban survived and Al-Qaeda endured in the lawless parts of Afghanistan. Similarly, civil war in Syria needs to erupt before they can find a foothold in Syria. Is it true where there's a strong government they will not thrive?
It depends on how you define thrive. Now, these guys can exist as a clandestine network and be very strong. If they are operating in a place with a strong sense of governance and a strong state, they'll still be there. They won't have the numbers and they won't have the capability to launch a terrorist army and take cities. But you won't be able to uproot them. Even when the Iraqi government was at the height of its powers, America was handing over and it was the best we'd ever, you know, the most we'd ever capability we'd send the Iraqi government had. They hadn't left. In fact, just a couple of years ago, the rate of suicide bombings was right back to where it was during the American occupation. It was impossible to root them out. Where it's only possible for them to thrive in the sense of claiming territory, yes, they will fill a vacuum. I mean, that's what's so revolutionary and extraordinary about what this Islamic State have done. Osama bin Laden never created a country. He never even controlled one. And the Taliban are not terrorists like Al-Qaeda. They have extreme views of religion, but they're much more of a Pashtun Afghan organization than they are anything to do with global international terrorism. They've never launched a terrorist strike of any kind beyond their own areas, beyond their own borders. They're a local force who had no global aspirations, unlike bin Laden. Bin Laden's never controlled territory. That's what Zarqawi did. He carved out a place. Even when the Americans were in Iraq, to harken back to Vietnam, if there was a caisson of the Iraq war, it was Ramadi, a city of 300,000, 400,000 people. And the Americans had to fight just to keep one road open. One road. And Zarqawi's people controlled the rest. So take away the Americans, create unrest in Syria, and let's not forget, half of the divide in the Syrian civil war is an Iranian-backed Shia government. It's a perfect petri dish for them to thrive. And there in the Syrian war, they were fighting side by side in competition with true Al-Qaeda. And they bullied them. To the point where earlier this year, in February, I think it was, Al-Qaeda itself, Zawahiri, who replaced bin Laden, disowned the Islamic State. They just ignored him and went on to strength to strength. Who dominates now? It's not the Al-Qaeda organization. It's this more rabid, more mongrel, more virulent strain that has won the day.
So Al-Qaeda is now the junior entity.
Oh, look.
To
yes,
IS.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I saw a Pentagon official just a few days ago say that the Islamic State is now the true alternative to Al-Qaeda. They have the juice. They had the momentum, and I saw reports online today that I think need to be verified, but Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is part of the true heartland of the Al-Qaeda organization, they issued a statement of support of the Islamic State. So we're even seeing core parts of Al-Qaeda start to fall in line. I mean, the power of Al-Qaeda and bin Laden was an idea. Very infectious idea within these communities of a way to fight. Come to us. We will teach you. We will train you. We will fund you. And then you go back as your own organization using our model and fight your local targets with local objectives and do that. There was a very powerful idea, a new way to fight holy war. This is an even newer idea that's proving even more effective.
The caliphate. The caliphate over real territory,
yes.
A new Islamic State.
It's more bloodthirsty. Okay, here was one great divide between Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda and Zarqawi's. Osama bin Laden doesn't really want to kill Muslims, certainly not innocent Sunni Muslims who happen to be standing in the marketplace or in the way. Zarqawi doesn't mind killing them. Because, in fact, in a way, it's not that you're doing them a favour, but we're making them a martyr and they go straight to heaven.
Al-Qaeda was being funded by oil money from Saudi Arabia, by and large. Osama bin Laden's own money in many cases. Who's paying for IS? Who's funding them? Who is giving them arms?
Oh, this is one of the true beauties of this organisation. They fund themselves. Taxation.
Taxation?
Yes.
From whom?
anyone within that, because, like, you know, they now control territory. You want to run a taxi? You got to pay your tax.
Are they running a proper government in these provinces
Absolutely.
That they're running?
Absolutely. They provide electricity. There's even reports of them providing a postal service. Certainly they're providing the police. They're providing the courts. They're trying to provide services. Now, this is one thing that they failed to do when they first claimed territory in Iraq. They went way too far and brutalised the locals. And that's what eventually led to these insurgents turning against them and siding with America. They've learned from the lesson. And trust me, they're going to impose a strict order wherever they are. And if you're not of their strict faith, then you are going to die or you are going to convert. And if you step outside the line, you will be punished brutally. But otherwise, they're here to provide what it is you need.
There are bureaucrats? They have bureaucrats.
Look, you have no idea how bureaucratic these guys are. More than Pol Pot and sometimes the Nazis. When these Iraqi insurgents drifted to al-Qaeda, Zarqawi's al-Qaeda, and were fighting with him because that's where the juice was, when the deal was cut with the Americans, en masse, they left. You know, there's very few ways that you can leave. Three guys I knew who were military officers under Saddam, insurgents, and then went to al-Qaeda because they had the money and the power and the leading the fight. When they drifted back, they were working for the top military intelligence official for Zarqawi's al-Qaeda. They went into his office one morning, as I'm told, so the story goes. They said, "Good morning, boss." He went, "Morning," and then they blew his brains all over the office. That's how they resigned. As they're leaving, one of them turned to the others and said, "Hey, do you think Mick would want his computer?" So the al-Qaeda's chief of military intelligence for all Iraq, his hard drive was brought to me. And what I found on there staggered me, the Americans, you know, so many al-Qaeda watchers. The paperwork was unbelievable. They had membership forms, membership application forms. They had exhaustive catalogues of their detainees and what happened to this person. They had expenses claims for fuel and for food and to conduct operations. We found in one folder 70-odd execution videos that were never made for public consumption. They weren't for propaganda. You would find a memo coming from you, my commander, Richard, to me saying, "Look, can you please take care of the problem of Bill Bloggs?" And then a couple of days later, I'd send a memo back saying, "Richard, I've read the Bill Bloggs situation. Please see attached video file." That's how bureaucratic they were.
I'm laughing. This is hideous, but I'm laughing nonetheless. So they combine that really Nazi-like, utter savage brutality and kind of embedded in this bureaucratic banality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just like the Nazis.
Absolutely. It's very strict. And so for them to be able to roll out a government, for those of us who know them, it's absolutely no stretch of the imagination. I mean, they're running oil refineries now.
That's a really complex thing to do, isn't it?
Ideally, what you do is what the Americans did. You go in, you brush away Saddam's regime, and then you've got all these power stations and oil refineries. Hopefully, you get the guys who were running them 2 weeks ago to come back and run them for you. And that's what we see them doing.
The new leader of ISIS, Islamic State, al-Baghdadi, operates in the shadows. Now, you're making a documentary about these guys. What do you know about this new leader, Al-Baghdadi? Do you know any more than most journalists do? Is he a real leader or is he just some figurehead?
Now, they say he comes from somewhere around the town of Samarra. He spent time in an American prison before he became who he is now.
He was picked up?
Yes. In an operation during the American occupation.
In Afghanistan or in
Iraq?
In Iraq.
This is before he was who he was. At that point, he was very junior or a hanger-on. I mean, this is another thing. I mean, we all know about Abu Ghraib prison and the photos and the scandals out of that. And then they set up an even bigger camp out in the desert called Buka prison, which still operates. And notwithstanding the ridiculous things that the American jailers did that horrified all of us, from the Bush administration to the local Iraqis, even putting that aside, what happens when you put someone inside a jail? I mean, it's criminals with other criminals. Who's the toughest gang in an Iraqi prison like that? It's the al-Qaeda guys. They set up their own little tent mosque. They'll set up religious schools. As one of the imams who was in prison said to me, I didn't just teach them the Holy Quran, I taught them holy war. They are factories of jihad, these prisons.
The prisons built by Americans to contain them.
And Americans were running them. I had a good friend of mine who was an Iraqi military officer. He got rolled up by the Americans at one point, and he went into Abu Ghraib when it was Abu Ghraib for 9 months. He didn't even know how to pray. He smoked, he drank. We used to sit drinking whiskey. When he came out 9 months later, he'd grown his beard. He'd stopped smoking. He wasn't drinking. He started praying, and he became a mid-level commander of Al-Qaeda.
The borders of the Middle East were drawn up famously by the British after the First World War.
Sykes-Picot.
Yes, all
God
of that.
Bless.
Yes, Churchill and I think T. Lawrence sat in on those things that they drew got out the compass and set square and drew lines across the desert and
That's
said,
it.
We'll put the sheikh of that here, the king of him there.
Purposely put the line between tribal, right down the middle of tribal areas so that they can't unite and be powerful enough. So let's put them on the opposite sides of this imaginary line in the desert. All good stuff.
Now, the Islamic State, formerly the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, the very name seems to be a repudiation of those old colonial borders.
Absolutely. They're tearing it up.
And will they stay torn up? Do you think those borders can be sustained?
This is going to be the great thing, isn't it? I mean, look, they aspire to the return of a caliphate. What is a caliphate, though? You know, it's a borderless country.
So are these lines on the map sustainable, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, they've stood the test of time over the last century, because what do? We created kings where there were none and then empowered them. And the deal was, keep providing the oil and you can do whatever you need to do within your own country to maintain power. I mean, that's effectively what we've done. And so far it's held. Why? Because we've invested enough interest in these clans, in these families, in these regimes, for them to maintain the order. So that's the current status quo. And it's the very thing Zarqawi wanted to shake up. That status quo. And goodness gracious me. Haven't they done that?
In 2006, Senator Joe Biden, who is now the Vice President Joe Biden, came up with a plan for Iraq, which was kind of poo-pooed at the time. He said, Iraq really is three different nations in one. Mm-hmm. There's the Sunnis, there's the Shias, and there's the Kurds. And we'd be really better off setting up a confederate system, if you like, a loose confederation where Sunni, Shia, and Kurds could have their own states within the states and go their own way under a very loose national government. Now that doesn't look like such a bad idea at all. What do you think of that,
Michael? Well, if you'd like to perpetuate this unending cycle of holy war, that'd be a great idea. I would disagree with the assessment that there's three Iraqs. I would argue there would be two, the Kurds in the north, totally different geography, totally different language, cuisine, culture, you know, and then the Arabs. Now, until Zarqawi showed up, the Sunni and Shia never really had a great problem with each other. They intermarried, they lived in the same neighbourhoods, they lived next door to each other. Goodness gracious, Saddam Hussein had Christians in his cabinet, at the upper echelons of his government.
His foreign minister was a Christian, as I recall,
right?
Wasn't he? Yeah.
Tariq Aziz.
Mm.
Zarqawi brought that and forced the ethnic cleansing of the capital, Baghdad, and many of the surrounding towns and cities. So really, there's a Kurdish and an Arab Iraq. If you want to divide the Arab Iraq into Sunni and Shia, then that means you're giving one all the oil and the other one scrubby bits of desert. Now, how are they going to survive? How are they going to fund themselves? We're already seeing that the Iraqi governments that we've seen, you know, since the handover of sovereignty, except for the first government where Prime Minister Ayed Alawi was installed, they don't like sharing with the Sunni. They don't provide basic federal government services. They'll fix the roads over here, but they don't fix them over there. Even the monthly flour and sugar ration that each family gets, they just stop delivering them to Anbar. They stop paying the civil servants there. Now, the hospitals can go to hell in a high water over there. It doesn't really matter. And these ones will be gleaming and lovely. Now, if you want to divide Iraq into those three areas, you're still going to have a very angry group of Sunni Arabs living in the desert.
One of the things about an intense group like IS is they produce interesting coalitions against them. So we have a situation today where we have the United States forming a kind of loose and probably very temporary coalition with moderate Sunni groups, mm-hmm. The Shia governments, and the Kurds and other groups to...
And Iran.
And Iran.
De facto Iran.
To push back.
But we've seen this before. When the Taliban was ousted, since the 1979 revolution in Iran, where they overran the US embassy and the hostages and the film Argo and all of that, since that time, the ouster of the Taliban was... You know, one of the first real times America and Iran's interests aligned. They both hated the Taliban. So the Iranians actually provided support, certainly in certain parts of the country, to get rid of the Taliban. When we come to Iraq, it was a totally different story. They were diametrically opposed to each other.
I just have this vision of, you know, American and Iranian diplomats getting together and go, God, how about these crazy bastards?
Look,
what are we going to do about it?
I've spoken to the diplomats who've done this.
Yeah.
It's been a fascinating insight to understand these things. But, I mean, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but that only lasts as far as it goes.
Do you think deep inside the Situation Room in the White House, where they have meetings of matters of national security, where there's the President sitting with the Vice President, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defence, Joint Chiefs of Staff, occasionally someone coughs and says, Mr. President, really, it would be in the United States' best interest if we just stepped back, let Iran and Hezbollah take the fight to the Islamic State, and us to keep back, and let's see these two sides wear each other down?
Well, they're not going to wear each other down, and that will make Iran, Israel very, very nervous. It's not going to keep the Saudis very happy or the Jordanians. I mean, this is where the Obama administration is damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. You know, they have a great reluctance, if you look at recent history, you can understand why, to re-engage, particularly militarily, in any kind of a big way, in this particular part of the world. There are lots of wounds in the United States that have yet to heal from that long, bloody war. Yet at the same time, if you leave it untended, I mean, we left the Syrian civil war untended, and now we have a third of Iraq that's been overrun by guys who are worse than Al-Qaeda. If you get involved, it could go wrong. If you don't get involved, it could go even worse. This is the great complexity of all geopolitics, but particularly as we now know of this region.
Yesterday we saw video footage of that journalist, James Foley, who was apparently beheaded by a member of IS. The jihadi who beheaded him spoke to the camera and had a British accent. Were we meant to notice that?
Oh, I think that was impossible not to notice. These guys are so savvy when it comes to message. They always have been, in terms of accessing new media and new technology, in crafting the nature of their message. They don't do anything like that without thinking about its import, about the iconography of it, about the statement behind it.
Well, what's the desired response from their point of view then, for us having seen that?
For us to look impotent. Which, effectively, we will. I mean, it very much reminds me of the situation that happened to three poor contractors in Iraq in 2004. Two Americans and the Brit Kenneth Bigley. They were grabbed by Zarqawi's people. Zarqawi's people rolled them out in the videos and said, look, if Bush and Blair, Prime Minister Blair, do not withdraw their forces, we will execute these men. Everyone knew that President Bush and Prime Minister Blair were not going to withdraw their forces. But one by one, they started beheading these guys. And with the Brit, they left him to last, and it seemed to have gone a little bit longer, as if to torment the British Prime Minister. Because who doesn't want to save one of your own nationals? But you know you're just not going to. There's nothing that you can do. But it was a very effective way to stick in a dagger and twist it. And that's what's happening here. Do you think President Obama is going to cease airstrikes over this? No. He can't. He can't stop. Not now that he's started. And they know that. But it's got you and I talking about it. It's got most of the Western world talking about it.
There is evidence that perhaps Australian nationals who are fighting over there as jihadists, it's supposed to make us wonder what happens when they come home, perhaps.
Well, of course. And I mean, you know, there's reports that an Australian was a suicide bomber just a few weeks ago in Baghdad. But this is no surprise, surely. Over the last 3 years, hundreds and hundreds of ardent young Muslims from Australia, from Europe, from America, have been flocking to this fight. So at the end of the day, is it really a great surprise that now we're seeing one with a British accent doing such a horrendous thing? It's really just a continuation. And it's like Afghanistan of the 80s. Al-Qaeda came from the veterans who came home. These are young Arabs who went to Afghanistan to fight against the Russians using our money and weapons. And once America turned their back on Afghanistan and the West forgot about them and things went bad, these guys came home angry. And that became the genesis of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda. So yes, there is a danger in what becomes of the veterans of these foreign holy wars. Whether the threat is such or so dire as to warrant, you know, some of the intrusions on our civil liberties that are being suggested or proposed, I question a lot of that. I am very hawkish on some of these things, having seen what I've seen and been through what I've been through. It's very hard to quantify the nature of a threat like this. But I will tell you it's not non-existent. It's, pardon the double negative. I mean, there is an issue there. How real or how large or how fervent is a matter of great debate and should be the matter of cool discussion and analysis.
Michael, it's been wonderful to speak with you again. Fascinating as it always is and hugely illuminating as well. Thank you so much.
Richard, thank you, mate.
Thank you for downloading this podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.